Howdy and welcome to Thin Air, news with an altitude from small town public radio in the Rockies and Four Corners. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Gina Garacio. Howdy. This month, Mesa Verde, before and after the fire.
These buildings have been standing here for 700 years using Aboriginal techniques.
Also, are you ready to pay more to drink water with less arsenic in it?
The APA is kind of caught between a rock and a hard place.
We bring you some tales of summer adventure from the Grand Canyon.
Definitely terrifying to have your heels hanging over a 400-foot drop with a waterfall coming out at your chest.
From Boulder, a report on the Forest Service Roadless Initiative.
But first, our monthly mosey around the Thin Air beat. In November, Colorado voters will decide on an initiative that hopes to slow down growth in unincorporated areas where it is expensive for government to provide new services. If passed, it would retroactively apply to projects submitted this month or later. Local planners say many developers are already trying to beat the deadline. The anti-growth measure, which comes from the Colorado Public Interest Group, or COPIRG, is under fire from mainstream observers like the editors of the Denver Post. Meanwhile, Colorado's resort areas continue to see applications for large new projects.
Nowhere is the growth pressure more intense than in the Brush Creek Valley, south of the town of Eagle, which is west of Vail. The owners of Adams Mark Hotels are back with another proposal for the Adams Rib Ranch, a 5,000-acre golf resort. Nearby is the proposed Frost Creek, another golf resort that would include 300 homes and commercial space on 1,100 acres. Frost Creek made COPIRG's Sprawl of Shame list of the 10 worst new developments in Colorado.
In Silverthorne, Colorado, the proposed Buffalo Mountain Golf Resort would include 355 new homes. The controversial project has led some Silverthorne residents to call for a halt to growth. Mayor Lou Del Piccolo told them that is not an option.
On Colorado's Front Range, Loveland voters will decide in November on a 2% annual growth cap. A similar measure failed back in 1994 when growth control advocates were outspent 10-1 by Citizens for Responsible Planning. In Glenwood Springs, the proposed Glenwood Meadows project would double that town's current traffic count and increase the population by 29%. Glenwood Meadows would feature 1,000 new homes and 1.2 million square feet of commercial space.
In Buena Vista, there's the proposed Trout Creek Village, which would feature commercial space north of town along the highway. Opponents call it strip development. Supporters say it would be good for the economy. In February, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will consider whether to declare the prairie dog an endangered species. Meanwhile, many towns still wage war on the little critters. Tony Todd reports for KBUT in Crested Butte.
Some people hate them. Others find them charming and cute. They are prairie dogs, and they've caused more than a little concern lately in Gunnison. A few weeks ago, construction began on a Comfort Inn at the intersection of Spencer and Main Street. The vacant lot has been home to a small colony of Gunnison prairie dogs for some time. Mark Taylor is a veterinarian at the Taylor Pet Care Center. He, along with other animal lovers, has made it his mission to save as many of the little critters as possible.
Getting involved in prairie dogs? Well, it was pretty easy because of doing what I do. And seeing them squished every day was kind of a challenge each day for me and my family.
Taylor says he simply wants to save the dogs from a cruel and inhumane fate. Unfortunately, he has not been able to find them a new home.
Division of Wildlife won't issue us a permit to trap.
The Colorado Division of Wildlife says it can't issue a permit until a relocation site has been approved. Neither the Bureau of Land Management nor the DOW will take them onto public land. They claim their hands are tied by what's known as the National Environmental Policy Act. NEPA, as it's called, requires government land agencies to complete environmental impact reports and hold a series of public hearings before relocation of the animals could be sanctioned.
It shouldn't be a big deal. There's so much bureaucracy. There's, you know, a 20-page manual on the procedures and policies that you have to go through in order to trap them.
Either the BLM or the DOW could utilize what is referred to as a categorical exclusion, which would enable them to bypass the NEPA process. Doing so might have given the Spencer and Main Street prairie dogs a fighting chance. Joe Capodice is a wildlife biologist for the BLM. He says that in addition to Taylor's original letter, his office has received a petition with 75 signatures and dozens of phone calls asking for help in relocating the prairie dogs.
Because of the interest this has generated, we have decided that to do a good job and maybe for the best thing for prairie dog management in the long run, that we would have to go through the environmental process and not use a category exclusion. I know how the people feel, and I kind of, when you drive by that, you see the existing town being built on and prairie dogs run over as they try to get out of the way or buried alive. I understand how they feel.
Sandy Shea is a spokesperson for High Country Citizens Alliance here in the Gunnison Valley. He says that there is a great need for myth-busting when it comes to prairie dogs.
I actually know a person who works for Gunnison County who is a very arch enemy of prairie dogs. It's unfortunate, ranchers have said, oh gosh, no, my horse is going to go lame, or some members of the public fearing that they're going to get bubonic plague from the prairie dog. Really, the chances of getting a serious disease from a prairie dog are quite small, and I would say you probably run into greater risk of getting hantavirus from mice.
If you saw a colony that had plague, most of it would be dead anyway, so it's not like we have any health threats or anything like that.
There are a lot of misconceptions, and a lot of it is just kind of from days gone by when guys just wanted to eliminate the prairie dogs so they didn't have those nasty holes in their front yard or what have you. And in doing so, we also eliminate a critical link in the ecosystem. And eliminating them for development or other purposes is not the answer. We've got to figure out a way to coexist with the little guys.
The city of Gunnison disagrees, at least as represented by its municipal code. According to Police Chief Jim Keeney, the city defines prairie dogs as pests and requires property owners to get rid of them. The city deems that they must be killed and will provide information on options for doing so. Despite its lowly status in the eyes of many, both Shea and Capodice feel that the Gunnison prairie dog, which is a unique subspecies, will soon be listed as either threatened or endangered.
I don't know how it's all going to shake out. What we do know is that the prairie dog is kind of another Gunnison sage grouse. It's likely that the Gunnison prairie dog will be listed in some fashion by the Fish and Wildlife Service probably within a couple of years.
Their numbers are much lower today than they were in the past. That I would hate to see the Gunnison prairie dogs go extinct.
Taylor says he's received threatening phone calls and has had customers pull their pets' records from his clinic. It seems that many people still fear or just plain dislike the prairie dogs and aren't too keen on his efforts to save them.
Bottom line is that they're a very social mammal. They're just like marmots. And, they have feelings, they have colonies. They have very low impact. To eat as much as a cow, you'd need 250 of them, and that would be a very big colony. All we want to do is relocate them and have them live out their lives in some other property where they won't impact anybody.
The prospect of finding public land to accommodate the few prairie dogs left on the lot is unlikely. Taylor is therefore looking for a private landowner who might offer a small parcel as home to the animals. There's another colony across the street on a lot destined for a new hardware store. This means that the battle over the Gunnison prairie dogs will likely continue. In Gunnison, for KBUT, I'm Tony Todd.
In November, the Colorado Wildlife Commission will consider a ban on sport hunting of black-tailed prairie dogs and new restrictions on poisoning them. Funds from Great Outdoors Colorado would be paid to landowners who maintain their prairie dog populations.
Earlier this summer, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency proposed to reduce the amount of arsenic in the nation's drinking water. Studies have linked ingestion of arsenic to bladder and lung cancer, as well as heart disease. Water utilities and local governments, especially in the rural Rockies and Southwest, are concerned that the EPA's proposed level would cost billions of dollars to achieve. David Summerstein reports from KRZA in Alamosa.
The EPA has regulated the levels of arsenic in the country's drinking water since 1975, when it set a maximum level of 50 parts arsenic per 1 billion parts water. In 1996, however, Congress passed the Safe Drinking Water Act, which mandated the EPA to lower the arsenic level by 2001. Arsenic is a naturally occurring element in the Earth's crust and comes in two forms, organic and inorganic. The inorganic kind is more toxic, and that's the kind typically found in water. So it's no surprise that Congress and the EPA wanted to reduce arsenic levels in the name of public health. What was a surprise, however, was the level the EPA proposed. Sandra McDonald is the drinking water compliance manager for the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment.
We knew it would be reduced from the current 50 micrograms per liter, but five was lower than what I anticipated it to go.
The EPA's proposal of 5 parts per billion is a 90% reduction in arsenic levels. The EPA also considered 3, 10, and 20 parts per billion, but settled on 5 based on a 1999 study conducted by the National Academy of Sciences. The study said arsenic levels should be lowered, but it did not recommend a specific level. The World Health Organization, for example, has set a maximum arsenic level at 10 parts per billion. Charles Fox is the director of water programs for the EPA. The EPA wanted to ensure a public health risk of no more than 1 in 10,000 incidents of cancer. But Fox's department was also concerned about the non-cancer effects, such as heart disease. And measuring those effects can be more of a guessing game.
And the science today does a better job of quantifying cancer endpoints rather than non-cancer endpoints. And so as decision makers, we must weigh ultimately what the quantitative benefits are as well as the qualitative benefits so that we can make good judgments on behalf of public health.
But the NAS study is based on much higher levels of arsenic exposure, and local water providers and utilities find the proposal too conservative. And for them, that means too costly. Doug Marsano is the spokesperson for the American Water Works Association, the nation's largest professional association dedicated to drinking water. He says the EPA's proposal would cost $15 billion in capital improvements to implement. That's to build new systems to filter out the additional arsenic, plus $1.5 billion annually to maintain. Marsano argues that the World Health Organization's accepted level of 10 parts per billion would cost a third less with little impact on public health.
All possibilities in this rule significantly reduce arsenic. I mean, we're talking to trace levels.
In fact, there are currently no plans for state or federal aid to rural communities to get set for the changes, but the EPA admits that in rural areas, average water bills could rise by as high as $200 a year, and it expects the rural Southwest to be the hardest hit. Don Koskelin is the director of public works in Alamosa, Colorado. He says the changes as proposed would cost Alamosa between $1.5 million and $3 million to implement. That's a big cost for a small town. And like the American Water Works Association, Koskelin also believes the research is not as complete as it should be. But he understands the delicate position of the EPA.
There's a lot of questions out there, and I don't know that the science fully supports them, but the EPA is kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, too, because they were mandated by a law to publish this rule by January of this year, and actually they slipped that by a little over 6 months. And in fact, there was a lawsuit against the EPA for that reason. I personally think they were pushed into putting out a rule that they didn't have enough information on. And because they don't have enough information, they're going to lean towards the cautious side.
Charles Fox realizes that the EPA's extra caution may put a significant financial burden on Southwest water drinkers.
There is concern about the potential costs of the arsenic proposal, particularly in some of the communities in the West and in the Southwest in particular. These are among the comments that we are going to consider very thoroughly before we make any final decisions at EPA.
Public comment will continue through August, and the EPA expects to release the final regulations in January of 2001. Regardless of the level established, water will be both more safe and more expensive. For Thin Air and the High Country Community Radio Coalition, I'm David Summerstein.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned all of this night, but coming forward to check, perhaps you've
caught it already on your radio. Listen, please.
You're listening to Thin Air.
Do you hear it? Curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. I'll move the microphone nearer. Here.
July 20th was Media Day at Mesa Verde National Park. I was there with several other reporters to hear about the Save America's Treasures program, funded by federal and private grants for millions of dollars. A team of 50 archaeologists and related specialists had been working on unprecedented mapping and high-tech documentation of Mesa Verde's backcountry sites. They had already studied 95 of these sites and planned to visit 50 to 100 more during the next year. We gathered in front of Spruce Tree House to hear the details while scores of tourists milled about nearby. The presentation was wrapped up by noon. On the way out of the park, I decided to stop near Moorfield Campground to hike to a vantage point of the Mancos Valley. When I looked up river, there it was, a smudgy brown cloud of smoke hanging over a blaze about as big as a house fire at the edge of the forest. From my perch a mile and a half away, I thought it might be a bonfire to consume slash that was getting a little out of control. Through the smoke, I could occasionally see red flames shooting above the treetops. I watched for a while and then drove to Cortez, where I looked back to see a massive wall of smoke now rising from behind the park, which was now being evacuated. An hour later, I was still seeing fire trucks leaving Cortez. I knew they had about a one-hour drive to reach the scene of what was to be called the Bercher Fire, which I had seen in its infancy when it could have been snuffed by a single drop of slurry. It gave me a helpless feeling about this season of wildfires. The Bercher Fire did not start in some remote, inaccessible, rugged piece of backcountry. It started just across a field from a well-traveled county road. In fact, Congress has now appropriated $3.6 million to build an air tanker facility at Durango that will be home to one plane from the nation's fleet of 80 air tankers. Completion of the facility is at least a year away. Meanwhile, the nearest firefighting aircraft continue to be based in Albuquerque and Grand Junction. If there's any good news, it's that the special archaeological team was able to complete a large portion of its task before the Holocaust. For more details, we present this tape from the last normal day at Mesa Verde National Park. Julie Bell is the archaeologist on the team responsible for assessing the condition of sites.
And we're just trying to tackle one sector at a time. All of these sites, incidentally, on here are alcove sites. The ones in yellow are the ones that we've completed work at this summer, and the ones in white are the ones that we will continue to go to. These sites range from size from one maybe very small storage room to a large dwelling of 65 rooms and five or six kivas.
Archaeologist Kathy Fierro has been in charge of coming up with plans for stabilization and treatment of each ruin.
What we do to modify a drip line is we use a bead of silicone caulking material, and we just apply it to the alcove. And so that makes the water drip where we want it instead of where Mother Nature has decided it should. And so often that will keep the water off the walls that we're trying to preserve. And water in the backcountry is our nemesis.
Architect Joel Brisbane heads up the architectural documentation of sites.
Architecture defines the social organization. Future archaeologists would be able to say a lot about us, such as we're a nuclear family and we hate our neighbors because we had big fences between us. Here, what we've defined is a dual organization. We found the same thing in Cliff Palace. It's called a moiety. The Pueblos still practice it today, where different halves of the Pueblo have different responsibilities as far as ceremonials go. One group will do summer ceremonies, one's responsible for winter. And you might have four, five, six families that share a single kiva. A lot of these houses in here, you look at it as one big entity right now, but this is built by accretion. And another group would come in and build their houses right up against somebody else. Planned expansion. When they finish off a building, they actually left tie stones hanging out of the wall, thinking in the future somebody's going to build up against them and this will tie them. We've not seen that anywhere else.
David Myers was leading the team from the University of Pennsylvania that specializes in plaster conservation.
Let me give you an example of a important kind of treatment we're using. It's using gelatin, which is a natural material. Not only is it a good approach from a conservation standpoint, it's been proven that it works, it's reversible, but from a cultural standpoint, it's been approved by affiliated native groups that claim association with the sites here.
Larry Nordby is field director of the overall efforts of the Save America's Treasures program.
In these alcove sites, we're able to use a minimal type of intervention. It sort of stands the principle on its head that these buildings will not stand much longer without heavy-handed treatments. That's converted into, well, these buildings have been standing here for 700 years using Aboriginal techniques. How can we try and mirror that behavior pattern and that decision tree such that we operationalize those same sets of preservation measures? And one of our ways to do that, of course, involves fairly intensive documentation. With respect to the average person wanting information on Cliff Palace, we should have the map by itself without the cross links back to the database available on the internet within a couple of months, which will be a very powerful tool, I think, useful to school children that would like to download that information, etc. Spruce Tree House should follow within probably 2 years.
In the span of an hour, my Mesa Verde story had been completely superseded by the Bircher Fire, which along with the August 5 Pony Fire scorched half the park, burning through 46 known cliff dwellings and revealing more than 1,600 previously unknown sites. Park officials now say the Save America's Treasures program is up in the air, and at least half of it will be realigned in the wake of the fires.
Craig Childs is a naturalist, teacher, and author who lives in Crawford, Colorado. In his new book, The Secret Knowledge of Water, Discovering the Essence of the American Southwest, Childs says that two of the easiest ways to die in the desert are from thirst and floods. Rory Tyler reports from KZMU in Moab.
First, I talked to Craig about thirst.
The book starts with looking at water holes, doing research down in Cabeza Prieta, for the wildlife refuge along the Mexican-Arizona border. I went down there for maybe 37 days or so, just going out using maps, some maps going back to the late 1600s, trying to find water holes and recording, you know, their depths, their volume, where they are, just putting together a map for the refuge. And just going up into all these canyons and following these washes and cracks, and sometimes 80 miles from the nearest road. In some cases, my map of water holes was my only way back. And, you know, I'd go out and find the next water hole out and then move out again and run out of water and say, okay, time to find the next one. And so mapping them was a necessity. Through Cabeza Prieta itself, the estimate is that in the last 100 years, over 400 people have died crossing. So I'm out here in this place where so many people have died, and you know, I've got to put together the water. I've got to find it where they didn't.
After I talked to Craig Childs about thirst, we changed the subject to drowning.
I spent 120 days inside the Grand Canyon as part of this book, and most of that was looking at the dynamics of flash floods, looking at the debris that they kick out, looking at the the erosion of the canyons and looking at how the floods work. And I wanted to find out what these floods are made of because, you know, you go into these slot canyons and you see these just amazing sculptures, just beautiful shapes carved into the canyon. And then you see the flood that makes these shapes. And the flood is just madness. It's just total chaos. And so you're looking at this flood saying, how is this complete chaos creating this ornate sculpture? And then seeing the flood, seeing boulders exploding and trees toppling end over end, just this flood of just vomited material hitting one wall and the next, and it's pretty mesmerizing and dangerous.
One of the things that happens in the Grand Canyon is there's some huge springs pouring out of the north rim, right out of the red wall, making mm-hmm. these giant waterfalls, and in one of the more terrifying and yet ecstatic passages in the book, you talk about climbing inside of the red wall mm-hmm. into the spring.
Yeah, two of us hiked for 80 miles actually to get to this one place and carried wetsuits with us and climbed up to this waterfall coming out of a cliff face, this spring, and put on our wetsuits and climbed into the waterfall, climbed into the spring, and went back into this extensive cave system, back inside of the desert. You know, the whole way along, I'm thinking, oh, I'm definitely going to die. You know, this is going to be a big mistake. I shouldn't be doing this. But, you know, for the opportunity to enter a desert spring, to get inside of it, you know, I really have no choice. You know, I wanted more than anything just to enter a spring, to see what it's like on the other side. You know, it's definitely terrifying to have your heels hanging over a 400-foot drop with a waterfall coming out at your chest.
And you equate it to the entering the sort of primal pre-state that the Hopi or the Zuni described in their mm-hmm. creation legends.
Mm-hmm. Because these particular springs, not the one that I went into wasn't actually any ceremonial spring, but there are other springs in the Grand Canyon that the Hopi and the Zuni say these are the emergence points. This is where we came from the last world into this one. And so, of course, I'm curious. I have this image of the Hopi and the Zuni climbing out of the last world into this one, and I'm climbing into it. And we're just bumping shoulders, and I'm going, I'm going inside, and they're looking at me going, okay, you do that.
Craig Childs is the author of The Secret Knowledge of Water, Discovering the Essence of the American Desert. Reporting for Thin Air, this is Rory Tyler.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is brought to you by the High Country Community Radio Coalition. You might be listening to KRZA in Alamosa and Taos, KAJX in Aspen, KGNU in Boulder, KDNK in Carbondale, or KBUT in Crested Butte and Gunnison.
Or you might be hearing us on KDUR Durango, KAFM Grand Junction, KZMU Moab, KVNF Paonia, KRCL in Salt Lake City, or KOTO Telluride.
Funding for Thin Air comes from your local station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.